Previously on Bingeworthy.
The Bible is history. It's narrative, it's poetry, law, gospel, letters, and literature. When Pastor Rob was a kid, he got a Bible of all that stuff for Christmas. He didn't like that God beget this and beget that, even though he was beget by God, or he wouldn't be here, but whatever. Pastor Javon talked about how movies are like the Bible. None of us knows why. But we do know that he doesn't like documentaries, even when his wife wants to see one. The creation story told us that God provides order, that God made everything good, that we were put in charge to provide good stewardship of the earth, that we were created in God's image, and that we depend on God for life. You left with the knowledge that Genesis and the story of creation is a real story about real people. You left knowing that we need and have access to a real God. And you left with popcorn. And that popcorn was praiseworthy.
You could have said binge-worthy.
That popcorn was...
binge-worthy!
I know!
So a little highlight from last week as we kicked off a new series on the Bible in 10 episodes. And we focused last week, as Matt shared, on the creation story, ending with the fall, the disobedience by Adam and Eve. And the rest of the first episode, if you've been using your devotional this week, which if you don't have one, if you're coming today for the first time, you can pick up a devotional outside of our church office. You can also get it online. But the readings this week were from the rest of those pre-patriarchal stories, Genesis 1 through 11. And they reflect what happens to humanity after the fall. Cain murders his brother Abel. God floods the earth because God was grieved over the evil in the world. People built a tower, the Tower of Babel, because they wanted to make a name for themselves. And so they end up with God scattering their languages so that they couldn't speak the same language anymore. And they live as different peoples all over the world trying to figure out how to get along. Well, that's a pretty good picture of life ever since, isn't it? People of different cultures, different languages, different nationalities, races, religions, trying to figure out how do we get along. God, help us. And so today we come to the next episode. When we turn the page from the end of chapter 11 to chapter 12, and we begin today biblical history. From now on, all of the events of the Bible can be dated. And so around the year 2000, God called a man named Abram to leave his home in Ur of the Chaldeans and travel all the way to a land that God would show him on the border of the Mediterranean Sea, the land of Canaan. This map gives you an idea of the path that Abram traveled. The question is, why did he go in such an indirect way, starting with Ur all the way to the right? That's the southern point of modern-day Iraq, the northern tip of the Persian Gulf. Why didn't he just go straight? Well, look at this next picture. This is the picture of the Fertile Crescent. This is ancient Mesopotamia, the cradle of civilization. This is where humanity began. The first human settlements were in this region. So the brown between the two is barren desert, no water resources. That would be the worst way to travel. Instead, Abram followed the Fertile Crescent through the fertile region with rivers and water resources to get to this promised land. Now, why did he go there? You turn to chapter 12 in the book of Genesis and you read these words, verses 1 through 3. As I read the words you see on the screen, you'll notice that several words stand out. They're capitalized. When I come to those words, I want you to join with me in saying those words out loud. So Genesis 12, 1 through 3, the Lord said to Abram, leave your country, your relatives, and your father's home and go to a
land
that I'm going to show you. I will give you many descendants and they will become a great
nation.
I will bless you and make your name famous so that you will be a
blessed.
Those three words form what is considered the Abrahamic covenant. Land, nation blessing. God has called Abram to go to a land that will be given to him so that he can be the father of many descendants who will be a nation for the purpose of being God's blessing in the world. Everything else we're going to read now, the rest of the Bible is based on this covenant. This is foundational to the rest of the Old Testament. These three simple words, land, nation, blessing. So today we come to episode 2 and what God does to form this covenant. I love talking to small business owners. Whenever you talk to a small business owner about what they do, their eyes light up. They start telling you about this product or this service that they believe is going to make people's lives better. They get excited and energetic. But when you ask another question, the energy goes away. The question is, what challenges you? And the answer is almost always the same. Employees. The people I've got to hire. It's the biggest challenge. People don't work hard. People will quit on you. Sometimes people steal from you. You can't always depend on. It's my biggest headache. I've got this great dream, but I have to carry it out through people. When you turn to chapter 12 in Genesis, and you read that God is now going to take the tact of exercising God's great dream to redeem humanity, to save them from themselves. But God is going to do it through people. You want to say, no, wait. There's got to be a better way, God. People are going to screw up. They are going to mess it up. They're going to let you down. But God has this dream of restoring the world to the way God meant for it to be in the first place. And God knows for that to happen, God's got to carry out that dream through people. So we come today to the first of the story of the patriarchs. This is basically the rest of Genesis chapters 12 through 50, the story of the patriarchs. And we begin with Abraham. We're going to cover a lot of territory, so buckle your seatbelt. Get ready. If you want to make notes, I encourage you to follow along in your outline as we look at all three of the key patriarchs. First, Abraham. Abraham is considered to be the father of faith, because he did as God said to go to this land he had not seen. Later in the New Testament, the book of Hebrews, the writer will talk about the heroes of the faith and begin with Abraham. It was faith that made Abraham obey when God called him to go to a country which God had promised to give him. He left his own country without knowing where he was going. Abram becomes the picture of faith, even though faith is what Abraham will struggle with. You see, Abram arrives in this land. He can see the land. Here's what he can't see: any descendants. He does not have a son, and the clock is ticking. Time is going by. He and his wife, Sarah, are getting older. My preaching professor in seminary used to say, when Sarah would ring the dinner bell in the evening and say, "All right, everybody, y'all come to supper," it was just Abraham. But they dreamed of a day when the dinner table would be full of kids and family, and they would have a sense that the whole reason they went there is actually going to come about, but they can't tell it yet. So God, every now and then, establishes a covenant with Abram. Covenant's a very important word in the Bible. A covenant is not just an agreement between people. It's not a contract. I mean, we understand how contracts work, right? You're bound to a contract unless, you know, athletes go to cities to play for teams where they sign big dollar contracts. 10 years or more. I'm not talking about current news now. Not talking about Andrew Luck. Not talking about Andrew Luck. But times when you say, well, wait, how is a player getting out of a contract after just 5 years? We thought that that was a commitment. Well, we understand today contracts get broken. You know, you just come to expect that. That's why we have lawyers, isn't it? Put a lot of fine print in the contract. Give you a way out. You got to have lawyers today. But when God's in the contract, it becomes a covenant. because God says, I'll never break it. So let's hear our first reading this morning. Susan's going to come up and read this passage that is the first time that God says to Abraham, who's worried that God's not going to come through, and establishes this covenant. Thank you, Susan. Guys, can you turn our microphone
on? Hello. Take two. We're reading from Genesis. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield. Your reward shall be very great. But Abram said, O Lord God, what will you give me? For I continue to be childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus. And Abram said, you have given me no offspring, and so a slave born in my house is to be my heir. But the word of the Lord came to him. This man shall not be your heir. No one but your very own issue shall be your heir. He brought him outside and said, look toward heaven and count the stars, if you can count them. Then he said to him, so shall your descendants be. And he believed the Lord, and the Lord reckoned it to him as righteousness. It's the word of God for the people of God.
Thanks be to God. Thank you, Susan. A pastor I knew one time said, a covenant is like this. A covenant is something we make in a moment of strength so that it cannot be broken in a moment of weakness. A covenant is something we make in a moment of strength. God gets Abram in a moment of strength and says, listen, I want you to understand, I am committed to you, so that in a moment of weakness, when Abraham feels like God's not going to come through, God will help him hang in there. Now, in this commitment, this covenant is very interesting, because after God spoke these words to Abram, he told him to go and do something. Take different animals, beginning with a heifer, a cow, and then a ram, and down from there, and cut the animals in two, and place the two ends of the animals facing each other so that it forms a river of blood. Turn to the person next to you right now and ask, why couldn't they have a secret handshake? Well, here's the reason. In that day and time, people would often do things like this when they were making an agreement with each other. They would sacrifice an animal, and one of them would walk through the blood, and then the other one, and they would say, may what happened to these animals happen to me if I break my word. But notice in this story what takes place. Abram falls into a deep sleep. And then we read these words, when the sun had set and it was dark, a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch suddenly appeared and passed between the pieces of the animals. Then and there, the Lord made a covenant with Abram. He said, I promise to give your descendants all this land. In other words, the smoking pot and the torch was a symbol of God. God was not saying that, Abraham, I want to know if you're dead serious or not. No, God said, I'm dead serious. It's God who passes through. Because God wants Abram to know, you're going to be able to count on me. I will never let you down. With God, never means never. And yet, Abram and Sarah struggle. Also, a key part about this story, this is when Abram's name is changed. Abram to Abraham. It's almost like God is reminding him by his name, you're going to be a father of many. You're going to be a father of many. Abraham. But they still question. So one day, now that they're about 100 years old, without any sign of possibility that they're going to have children, Sarah says to Abraham, look, take my servant girl and have a child with her. Now that sounds really odd to us, but back in that time, that was a part of custom. Now it wasn't God's idea. Not everything in the Bible is told to say that this is the way God means for things to be. It's told to say this is just the way the world is sometimes, and God can still work through it. So Abram has a child with Sarah's servant girl. It wasn't God's idea, but God is still going to work through it. And later, God comes to Abram and Sarah in the form of three men and visits them and says, by this time next year, you're going to have a child. Now, it seems so ridiculous by this point that Sarah, who's in the kitchen cooking, overhears this and starts laughing. It's laughable to her that they're going to have a child. But a year later, guess what? They have a child. Sarah's old enough to be in the geriatric ward, and she's having a baby. Can you imagine the nurses at the nursing home saying, get the obstetrician, somebody in room 109 is having a baby. I can't explain it, but that's what's going on in the story. So when the child is born, what else would they name the child? Laughter. Laughter. Isaac means laughter. You could actually look ahead on the outline on the other side and go ahead and write that in. Isaac means laughter. Isaac means laughter. But before we go, I want you to flip back to the other side of the page, because this rock formation up here this morning has a very important point to us. When Isaac was little, God tells Abraham to take Isaac out to a place called Moriah. And he says to Abraham, I want you to sacrifice your child Isaac there. You'll find a place, you'll find a rock, sacrifice him to me. Now, what perhaps seems startling to us is why God would ask such a thing after taking so long to make this promise come about. But what really is more startling is why Abraham would do it. Until we understand that Abraham lived in a culture where this was not unusual at all. People worshiped fertility gods. And they believed that in order for the gods to bless you and to give you success, you had to offer the first of anything you had, the first of your garden, the first of your cattle and your animals, and that included your children. You offer the first child. Abraham would have seen people doing this all the time. He would have watched people go out to high places and sacrifice their firstborn children. It's unbelievable to us today, but it was believable to Abraham when he felt, however he got that message from God, that God was asking him to do this, he probably thought, well, I guess I'm not going to be that different after all. So he comes to this place, Moriah, and he puts Isaac on the rock altar, and he raises a knife to strike the child, and God prevents him. God says to Abraham, now I know that you really do trust me. I don't want you to sacrifice your child. That's why I sent you to this land, to show people a different way, to show people that that's not what God wants for them, to be my blessing in the world. And now I know that you trust me above all. Abraham looks over, he sees a ram caught in the bushes. He takes the ram, he sacrifices the ram on this place, and he says, God has provided. That's the meaning of Moriah, the Lord will provide. There's a great spiritual point there. God provides what we need to be faithful. God called Abraham to make a sacrifice. God provides what we need to be faithful. My first building campaign I did as a pastor, I asked a retired pastor to be the chair of our committee to raise the money. When it came time to make our pledges, this pastor told his story. He and his wife had been praying about what to give, and they came up with a number. They both felt peace about it. It was about twice what they were already giving to the church. So they wrote the number down on their pledge card, but then they said, how are we going to do that? We're living on a pension now. We don't have the resources to do that. The next day, he went out to get his mail, and in the mail that day was a letter from the Duke Endowment. In North Carolina, the Duke Endowment supports retired clergy. He opened the envelope, and in the envelope was a check for the exact amount of the pledge he made to the dollar. He said, I'm increasing our commitment because God has reminded me God provides what we need to be faithful. A couple of points before we leave here. This place is called Moriah, Abraham was the first to sacrifice here. This is the beginning of the sacrificial system in the Old Testament. All of the Old Testament worship based on sacrifice started on Moriah. Later on, King David would come along and he would buy this land. He would buy this rock. He wanted it to be a place to build a temple to God. His son Solomon would do that. So the temple in Jerusalem was built over Moriah, over this rock. This rock is still there today. It's actually now a holy Muslim site. The building today, the gold dome that you see in Jerusalem, is called the Dome of the Rock. The Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem, built where the ancient Jewish temple stood over this place. So that's Abraham. Now we come to Isaac. There's not a lot told about Isaac in the Bible, except for a very important moment when he affirms for himself the covenant with God. So Susan's going to come back and read that part of the story to us.
And that very night, the Lord appeared to him and said, "I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not be afraid, for I am with you and will bless you and make your offspring numerous for my servant Abraham's sake." So he built an altar there, called on the name of the Lord, and pitched his tent there.
Thank you, Susan. I like the way that ends. He pitched his tent there. It's sort of like saying this covenant now that he has made personally for himself is a place where he can dwell. He can live in that. Now, he doesn't just talk about the faith of his father, he talks about his faith. In fact, leading up to this story, there's this little episode in which Isaac has gone back to dig up the wells that his father Abraham had once dug, but other people filled them in. He digs up these wells one after another, and then one day he digs his own well, and that's where the covenant is made. It's almost as if God is saying to him, "I'll give you your own fresh supply of my presence." We can't live on the faith of other people. We can't rely on the faith of our parents, no matter how strong it was, or the faith of our grandparents, or the faith of a good friend. At some point, when we need it, when we need our own deep resources of God's power and God's help, we all have to say our own yes to God. This is kind of a silly illustration. But last week, Susan and I ate dinner with Tom and Nancy Lang, and one of the two of us, and I won't say who, has been telling the other one for a long time, you need to put a key to the house on your keychain so that if ever we get stuck and the garage door doesn't work, we'll be able to get in the house. Many times, one of the two of us, and I won't say who, has said this to the other one. So we're driving home the other night. The one to whom this advice has been given is the one driving with that person's keys. And the other one who's riding did not take that person's keys that has a key to the house. And a thunderstorm came up and we pulled in the driveway and the electricity had gone out in our neighborhood. The garage door button is bringing no response. So the passenger said to the driver, "Let's use your key that no doubt by this point in history you have put on your keychain so that we can get in the house." And at that point, the one to whom this instruction had been given across many years confessed that that person had never put a key on the chain. Now, fortunately, we have a daughter who lives in downtown Indianapolis who has a key to the house, and an hour later, we could get in. Silly story, but faith is like a key. It opens you to the abode of God, and everybody has to have their own. You cannot rely on someone else's key. In a crisis, in a moment of need, we all have to have our own key to open us to God's peace, God's power, God's forgiveness, God's help. We all have to have our own key, and that's what Isaac reminds us. So now we come to Jacob, and this is the real fun part of the story. Jacob has a twin brother named Esau, and they were born to Isaac and Rebekah. And when they were in the womb, they would struggle with each other. And when they were finally born, Esau came out first. Big deal, because all of the birthright went to the oldest. But as they're coming out, Jacob reaches out of the womb to grab the heel of his infant brother Esau, and therefore he's named Jacob, clutcher, grabbing the heel of. And it foreshadows their boyhood, because Jacob would be trying to clutch everything Esau had. Later, when they were boys, he would dupe his brother out of his birthright. And then when they were young men, he would dupe his father into giving him the blessing that belonged to his brother Esau. And so Jacob represents tricks. He's a trickster. He represents tricks. But he'll get it coming back to him one day. You see, when he finally took the birthright and the blessing away from his brother was so mad he was going to kill him. And so his mother intervened. Rebekah sent Jacob back to the land where she came from to see her brother named Laban. So Laban is Jacob's uncle, right? He goes back to Laban's house, falls in love with Laban's daughter, Rachel. Are you following the relationships right now? Jacob wants to marry his cousin. Ick. Unless you're from the Appalachian Mountains like I am, and then it's just kind of how it goes down there. So Laban says to Jacob, okay, I'll let you marry my daughter, but you got to work for her for 7 years. So he does. He makes an agreement, works 7 years. The wedding comes. They have a great party. Except Laban now tricks Jacob. On the wedding night, instead of sending his daughter Rachel into Jacob's tent, he sends Rachel's older daughter, Leah, into the tent. Now, either it was really dark or Jacob had a lot of wine to drink at the wedding party, but he doesn't know until the next morning that he's with another woman. He thought he married one woman, only to discover after they got married, she was somebody different. Can anybody say amen? Careful, 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 careful. All right, back to the story, back to the story. Laban says to Jacob, I tell you what, we'll work another deal. You can have Rachel if you work for me for 7 more years. So he does. He works in 14 years now. Now he has two wives, Rachel, the one he loves, and Leah. But life only gets harder because now Leah is jealous of Rachel, whom Jacob loves, but Leah can give Jacob sons. And so she does. First, Jacob has 4 sons with Leah. He has Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. And then later on would come Issachar and Zebulun, 6 boys. Now Rachel is the jealous one, but she can't have children, so she gives Jacob her servant girl named Bilhah. Where have we heard this story before? Bilhah has 2 sons with Jacob, Dan and Naphtali. Now Leah can no longer have children, so she gives Jacob her servant girl named Zilpah. She has 2 sons with Jacob, Gad and Asher. I mean, this is getting ridiculous, isn't it? Let me tell you how bad it got. The wives would barter with each other. They would trade to see who gets Jacob for the night. One day, Jacob came into the house, and it was supposed to be Leah's night, but Rachel gave Leah her mandrakes to have Jacob for that night. Mandrakes were like an ancient aphrodisiac. They were the Viagra of the day. You know, there are many of you I never see take a note during the sermon. I just saw a lot of men write down just then on their outline. I bet there's going to be a run on mandrakes in Indianapolis this week. Well, they must have worked, because now at long last, Rachel is able to have two sons, Joseph and Benjamin. Now, why have I told you all of this? Because these are the 12 tribes of Israel. These 12 sons become the 12 tribes of Israel. What a screwed up family. Are you feeling better about your family now after hearing this story? You're thinking, man, mine's not so bad after all. But yet God works through them. So now Jacob knows it's time to go home. It's time to go back to that land that was promised to his grandfather, that was promised to his father, that he knows is promised to him and that's been affirmed. But in order to do that, he knows he's got to face his brother Esau, and he's scared to death. He gets near where he knows Esau is encamped, and he sends gifts ahead to Esau. And when he finally sees him face to face, he realizes his brother is not angry with him anymore. He's not mad with him. And when they hug and embrace, Jacob says to Esau, "Seeing your face is like seeing the face of God." Do you know what he did there? He gave grace a chance. He gave grace a chance to provide a future. We always have a future when we just give grace a chance to work. Now, something very important happened right before they met, the night before. Jacob's anxious, he's nervous, he goes off to be alone, and there God sends an angel to meet him, and they wrestle each other. They wrestle and they struggle all night long, and when the sun comes up, Jacob is limping and he's walking away, and the angel gives Jacob a new name. He says, "From now on, your name is Israel." Israel means struggles with God. "From now on, your name is Israel." And so the God of the patriarchs, as the Old Testament will refer over and over, is the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Why don't we say the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel? Because wasn't that God's plan to Abraham to begin with? "I'll give you a nation." Why doesn't God say Abraham, Isaac, and Israel? As if to say God's promise has come about, because God is reminding you and me that God works through Jacobs. God works through faith and laughter and tricks. God works through the best of us. God works through the worst of us. And we've all got stuff that we would be tempted to believe, like a false narrative we write down on a card, that God can't use that. That's beyond God's ability to use. "I'm not good enough. I'm not smart enough. Other people can do it better." But God comes to every person and he says, "I want to form my covenant with you and use your life." One day a disciple named Simon would be tempted to believe he wasn't good enough to follow the Son of God. And Jesus would say to Simon, "From now on, your name is the Rock, and I will build my church on this rock." Was he talking about this rock? The place that Jesus and his disciples could see standing in Jerusalem, the temple that was built over this rock, the place where God provides, where people like Abraham are willing to say, "God, I will trust you above all." Jesus is saying to Peter, and he still says it today, "This is what I need to carry out my great plan to redeem the world, is to let me use your life. Will you let him use yours? Will you be a rock that God can depend on?"